So in this class, we are, it's the second class on time. And as you will have seen in the reading, Rinpoche really emphasizes the importance of time as the force that activates the TSK vision and brings it alive. So, of course, time and space and knowledge are all important. But when we're talking about time, we want to emphasize the part that really has the power that time brings to the vision. And in part, that's what we'll be talking about today. So this is our second of two sessions on time. And then the next couple of weeks, we're going to be working with knowledge. And that will be our first run-through. So by the end of this session, we will have kind of introduced ourselves to the different facets of the vision. In the first session, we talked more about the TSK style of inquiry, and we looked into that. And now we're actually starting to get into the substance. So I may send out an email for the teacher trainees to make sure we've got that system up and running. But that'll be separate. I'm not going to talk about it now. So let's go ahead and get started. So the very beginning of the reading, so it's this chapter 7, which is called The Path from Ordinary Time to Great Time, an overview. So as an overview, it fits in very well with what we're doing. At the very beginning of it, Rinpoche says, if we start to open up to great time, we may have a sense of greater control and balance, control over our lives and balance as the events of our lives unfold. And then he says, that's a good thing. And I suppose everybody would agree that that's a good thing. But he says that the fact that we do experience control and balance doesn't actually mean what we think it means. It doesn't mean that now we have more control and now we're in more balance. It just looks that way. It just seems that way. And it's worth exploring that, I think, to say why. You know, so why is that? And he says a little more about it. When I first read that sentence, actually, when I was starting to prepare for this class, I thought, well, that's because experience, so the experience of control, is not exactly trustworthy in the usual sense, because our experience is always based on a self that's having the experience. And that is a point that Rinpoche discusses and that the TSK books go into in different places. But as I read further, I realized that's not the point that he's making here. The point that he's making here is different. The point here is that the sense of control and balance is based on the idea that we have to control something or we have to come in balance with respect to something. But in fact, there isn't anything that needs to be controlled. You know, he's talking about great knowledge here, and throughout this chapter, he's really talking about the relationship between time and knowledge. So we'll come back to that at various points. But he's talking about great knowledge, and he says, from a great knowledge perspective, there isn't anything there that needs to be controlled, and there isn't a more open view that we can choose, so that we then become. We then see things more clearly, and also there's no particular sense of lower time, something that we need to transcend or overcome, let's say. All of those structures don't really operate from the point of view of great time. And you know, I think that could be maybe confusing, so let's go over it for a moment. The reason it's possibly confusing is that that's how we see the world. That is, you know, why would you study TSK? Well, there's many reasons you could give, but one way of saying it is the one that he just introduced at the end of the last chapter and that he starts with this time. If we're more in tune with time, we have more control over the way that time manifests or unfolds in our lives, and we're more balanced. But here he's saying, fine, good, nice, but that's not really a very accurate way of understanding what great time and great space and great knowledge are about. We don't really rely on that kind of change. And the reason we don't is because as long as we're thinking in terms of a change and improvement orientation, which is a way that Rinpoche has talked about earlier in this book, as long as we're thinking that way, we're still looking in terms of our ordinary understanding. And if we could look more from the great knowledge side, things wouldn't look like that at all. There wouldn't be anything that needed to be changed. There wouldn't be anything that needed to be controlled. That whole way of looking is based on a certain understanding of time, our ordinary understanding that's in operation, and it doesn't. It's not a very accurate way of looking, and the reason it matters as to whether it's accurate, I mean, in principle, it's always good to be accurate rather than inaccurate, but the reason it matters is that you can only go so far. If you adopt the lower time perspective, you're going to bump up against a wall, because lower time is in fact a narrowed down, a confined, a restricted way of understanding, and lower knowledge, of course, and lower space as well. And so as long as we hold on to that perspective, we are guaranteeing that we're going to come up against limits. Our lives may improve. We may benefit from the study of the vision, from doing the practices and so on, from really reorienting ourselves. But we'll be doing it from within a lower time perspective and a lower knowledge perspective especially. And that's a built-in limitation. So I don't think that means that we need to drop our change and improvement orientation, because it can motivate us and it can help us understand what the significance of the vision is. But we do need to understand or recognize that it's limited. And so even while we're looking for signs of the impact of TSK in our lives, let's say, because that's very natural. No, why would you be studying TSK if you didn't think there was going to be some kind of change or improvement? Even as we're looking in that way, we recognize that that is a lower level orientation. And what that means is something we'll be going into more today, and we're going to continue to reflect on that throughout the course, because we're trying to set in motion or set in place or activate, that's a little better, we're trying to activate a new vision. And so we keep reminding ourselves, here's how the old vision operates. Even when we have reoriented our thinking, even when we have started to question our usual assumptions, it's very natural to stay within that and to understand the vision from a lower level perspective, which in a way means not understanding it fully. But we do what we can. And little by little, a transformation is set in place. And that's why I think in this first book especially, there is a very strong sense of a path to great knowledge, a kind of an unfolding in which we activate it, you could say, one step at a time. We start off with our ordinary understanding, which means we don't even consider that there's another possibility. And then we begin to wake up to the fact that there are other possibilities. So that, you know, this first TSK book starts off with the notion of space as the local representative of the sky as the local representative of space. So we recognize that, you know, the symbol, the sky is a symbol of the possibilities that space offers, is a an invitation to go further. So it's a little bit like, the image that comes to mind is really one more from the Tibetan Buddhist perspective, and I'm not offering it because it's Buddhist, but just because it's the right kind of image. The story of how Buddhism came to Tibet is that in the 4th century, I think it was, about 300 years before Buddhism actually became established in Tibet, some texts mysteriously appeared. They fell from the sky. And people had no idea what those texts were, but they realized they were something special. And so, they honored them, they respected them, and waited for knowledge to grow. And you could say, we start to see our world as something that has a kind of deeper dimension, a kind of a mysterious dimension that we don't really understand completely. But it points us in the right direction. And so that's the kind of inquiry that we undertake. And so one way of thinking about that is that time and space and knowledge themselves, operating more or less in their ordinary way, but with the recognition that there are other possibilities, that time and space and knowledge are themselves symbols, or you could also say restricted versions of the vision that we want to put into place. And if we see them, if we see our experience, our temporal experience, our spatial experience, our ways of knowing, as giving us the opportunity to move forward as symbols. Rinpoche, has, again, in this chapter, emphasizes at one point this notion of the symbolic power of our ordinary experience. It's not just our ordinary experience, but it's a symbol of other possibilities. If we see it that way, then we can move on. So the starting point, or a starting point, and the reason I brought it back to time and space and knowledge as a symbol of these possibilities, is to recognize that time, that's where we're focused right now, that time itself, as we experience it, is a manifestation of a particular way of being, which brings with it a particular way of knowing. So there's a passage on 137, a couple of passages, where Rinpoche says, our whole state of existence, this is at the very top of 137, he says, we can characterize the whole state of existence in which we find ourselves as being due to lower time. And then a little later, let's see if I can find that, he says, he's talking about the pattern of time unfolding from moment to moment. And he says, this series is the only pattern we know. In fact, this pattern is what we are. So we go along with it, even if it can sometimes seem quite threatening. So we're experiencing ordinary time, we're experiencing ordinary space, we're experiencing acting through and out of ordinary knowledge. And that's who we are. So you could run that in both directions. You could say our conviction, our certainty that we are a self, that I am me, leads to a certain way of engaging time and space and knowledge. Or you could say the other way around, the way that time and space and knowledge appear for us guarantees that we're going to stay in the perspective of a self having specific experiences, encountering specific objects in the world, and forming intentions and wishes and desires in accord with the what we understand, what we know things to be. So there is a way we have of being in space and time and knowledge that is who we are. There's nothing, it's not as though first we're here and second we begin to know in a certain way and experience time in a certain way. It's that our way of being here manifests as a particular, not quite focal setting, but let's just use that for now, as a particular focal setting on time and space and knowledge. So they're all interrelated, all three of those factors. And that's why Rinpoche, you know, talks in terms of these three factors. So all of that can change. And ultimately, I think that's a question of developing a new vision. That's why this is called a new vision of reality. And the place to look, in a sense, is at knowledge. I mean, the central point is we have a certain way of knowing the world to be. We know that things are a certain way, and that involves time and space. And in a new vision, our very sense of what it means to know would be transformed. And so vision and knowledge are closely related, but at the same time, our way of experiencing time and space would also be transformed. So Rinpoche says some things in this chapter, in this reading about science, and I think it's useful to point out a key distinction here. Science or philosophy could come up with a different theory about what reality is. But a theory is not a vision. And it's interesting because the word theory, as we've probably mentioned before, comes from the Greek word for seeing. It comes from the sense of it's closely related to the word vision. But one of the nice things about English, as compared to some other languages, is that the sources for English come from so many different places. They come from the Greek and the Latin, but they also come from the Anglo-Saxon and from the French and from many different places. And so we have all these words that kind of mean the same thing, but they all have different shades of meaning. I think English is a little bit more that way than some other languages. And so the words theory and vision, if you take them back to their root, mean the same thing, but they also mean something completely different. Science works out new theories, new views. But those views presuppose a certain understanding of space and time, and they never challenge it. If you have a new vision, that means transforming the way that space and time operate. There's really no way to separate them out. That's an important distinction. We'll come back to that a little bit later, I think. So Michael has a question here. He says, if we are lower time, or if we are lower time, that seems to refute the possibility that we are a soul submerged under mistaken impressions. So who wakes up? Okay, let me make sure I understand that, Michael, and if I don't, let me know. Maybe unmute yourself so that we don't have to do it all by your typing. You're saying that there is this self, this soul, that is operating on the basis of a certain fundamental misunderstanding. And if we could clear away that misunderstanding, then we would, wake up, as you say. And I think that's right. That's not right. that way of understanding it attributes too much substance to the idea of who we are. It's saying, well, first there's the self, and then the self is going to wake up to a new vision of time and space and knowledge. No, the self is a particular understanding of space and time and knowledge. And if we wake up, if we activate the vision, let's stay within the language of TSK, if we activate the vision, the self doesn't wake up because there. It turns out that there isn't one of those. It's like the beginning of the chapter that says, you know, we can't really even talk about control and balance, and we can't talk about a self who now understands things more clearly or more completely. This new understanding is not going to be the self's. Now, that doesn't mean the self disappears, that we just collapse or expand or turn into something other than a self. But it means that the power, the realness that we assign to our sense of self, that's going to be undermined. That's going to be gone. So no control, no balance, no self, from a great time perspective. Okay, does that answer your question, Michael? Yes. Right. But you know, that doesn't mean that you've lost something significant or lost something at all. So it's like, oh, TSK has taken away my sense of self. This is terrible. No, not really. There isn't anything to be taken away. It's only a particular orientation that we have. And it may seem like the shift to a different orientation is a really radical shift. Not exactly. I mean, in one way, yes, but only from a lower level perspective. You know, in another way, from a great time perspective, let's say, or a great knowledge perspective, there's also no shift. You know, nothing drastic happens. It's not like somebody takes a sword and cuts off your head. That's the self's version of what would happen. But no, there's no head to be cut off. You know, we can sort of play around with that, but let's move on. Okay. So when Rinpoche talks on page 136 about the vision or the, no, not the image, not the vision exactly, but our ordinary understanding that time flows or time passes, he says it's kind of useful because that's how we think about it ordinarily, but at the same time, the very notion of time passing or flowing at least relates to the dynamic of time. But it's only going to be a kind of a temporary understanding. The thing about science, let me go back to science for a moment. The thing about science is that even though a scientific understanding in some ways, sometimes is radically at odds with our usual experience. So the obvious example, of course, is quantum physics and its different manifestations. It makes all these claims that make no sense at all. And Rinpoche does talk about that later in this chapter. Maybe we can get back to it. And you say, oh, it's really fundamentally different, but it continues to accept the usual fundamentals of space and time and knowledge. And to the extent it doesn't, then you end up with a sense of, well, it's a mystery, it's a paradox, it doesn't make any sense according to our usual logic, and you're just kind of stuck. You say, well, that's the way it works. Science continues to accept the notion that time passes from flows, from moment to moment, even though, as some of you may know, in terms of physics, that model doesn't work very well, because in terms of physics, time should be reversible. There shouldn't be a past and a future. Movement should go in all directions. So you know, time, the theory of time works a certain way, but it doesn't, time doesn't, science doesn't help us move out of our usual understanding. And that's really, you know, what the vision is wanting to do. So we talk about a kind of a vantage point here. Rinpoche says that. Let's see if I can find that. I think it's on 136. I don't see it at the moment, actually. That's not so important. But a vantage point, you know, again, involves this distance of being at this image of being at a distance. We take a certain perspective. Really, the vision needs to go beyond that, is going to go beyond that. So what Rinpoche is doing now is starting to move beyond that. And, you know, he's going to introduce these three stages of time. And it's interesting that he uses the word stage instead of level. You know, we usually talk about different levels of time and space and knowledge. But here he talks about stages in the appreciation of great time. So if you're thinking in terms of knowledge, it's like you come to a greater understanding. And those are stages. It's not, maybe not so important, but it's good to recognize that he's doing something a little different. We're going to try to do something. We're going to try to activate a greater appreciation. That's what he's suggesting here. And one of the things he says, and I think it's really important in terms of our strategy or how we're going to approach this, and in terms of TSK inquiry generally, is that we can do this through thinking. Thinking is a very useful tool in this way. So, you know, people who come out of different meditative traditions have a tendency to be convinced that the problem is thinking, you know, that if we could just experience directly and drop our thoughts, drop our interpretations or judgments, that we would arrive at a different way of being. And there's some truth in that. But the problem, and a kind of fundamental problem, and Rinpoche talks about this a number of times, he talks about it in this chapter, the problem with kind of the usual understanding of what meditation is all about, just to take that as an example, is that we continue to operate with the usual space, the usual time, and the usual knowledge, and we think we can transform our knowledge without transforming our understanding of how time and space operate. And it's just not going to work in the way we think it does or might. It's going to leave the structures of time and space in operation, and therefore there's not going to be the possibility of opening to a completely different vision. And that's a distinction that Rinpoche wants to bring up. So what he's saying right here is that because we're interested in this complete transformation, we need to hold open the possibility of thinking our way into a different vision. It's not that thinking can do that, but it can be very helpful. So if we take a look at the first paragraph on page 141, he says, he's talking about science and how science challenges the ordinary understanding in a particular way, which is not the way that TSK challenges them. If you want to look at that, take a look at the bottom of page 140. But here he says, when we look at our ordinary understanding, we wind up, we recognize there are certain problems with that understanding. It's kind of clumsy. It doesn't work. And then he says in the first full paragraph on 141, problems of this sort in our science, living, and thinking can encourage us to use thinking and observing in new ways, to break through the partitions defining things. In this way, thinking can imitate time's penetrating evocation of great space. And a little later down, he says, deeply thinking things through may be the first step toward approximating higher time. And he says that's kind of what's going on in the giant body exercises. But I would say more generally, that's what goes on a lot in the TSK books. We're trying to think things through in a different way. And I like this phrase, think things through, because it also suggests thinking through things. You know, we have a way of seeing, which is very thing-centered. And we want to go through that to a different kind of understanding, through in the sense of moving beyond it, you know, like going through a barrier. And thinking can help us do that. And these, you can say that a lot of the TSK books are, a lot of the material in the books involve an invitation to think things through differently, to allow for different possibilities, and to let that work on us, you know, so that it becomes an exercise. It really is an exercise to read these books, and that's why you want to read with a lot of care. And that's why that's really why we have these classes. To some extent, we introduce exercises also. But we need to think things through so that new possibilities present themselves. Because otherwise, you know, you can have all sorts of experiential experiences and all sorts of insights on the result, on the basis of those experiences, but they will stay within a particular structure, a particular model. They won't let us appreciate great time, as that's what we were starting to look at on page 136. So we're going to do a lot of, you know, we do in this program, and in general, if you follow, if you read through and work with the TSK books, you're thinking things through. You're allowing for possibilities. And the exercises are an experiential way of thinking things through. It's like, you know, you create a different condition by doing an exercise. Let's just to take an example, subject-object reversal, although that's a pretty sophisticated example. But any kind of exercise, reversing time or so many different things, you say, what if it's like that? And so you bring experience and thinking together in the exercise. So the kind of formal exercises are a way of doing that. But you also, you know, I've been assigning these what I call walking around exercises or walkabout exercises, right? They're also ways of thinking things through. So it's not just sort of, you know, scratching your head, sort of sitting there and saying, well, I wonder what it would be like to be like that. That stays pretty theoretical. The thinking and the experiencing come together. Okay, so Karin asks a question. Why does the self experience that things are going more my way when we engage in the TSK vision? Is it the first step of opening and loosening up? And the answer, the short answer is yes. I think that's exactly right. But then let's take a look at what it says. It's on page 143. If you look at the about six lines from the bottom of that page, he says control, that is when the self feels more in control, and another way of saying that is things are going more my way, right? When the self feels in control, that's the self's way of describing the result of opening to a greater appreciation of time. So the self has, you know, you work with TSK and things get better. And you say, oh, great, things are better. Well, that's the self's way of experiencing what the TSK vision is about. And it's really, really important, because otherwise you have no motivation. You have, you know, what's the point? But it is the self's way. As you say, Karin, it's the first step of opening up. And Michael has a question about thinking things through. Does thinking things through reach the limits to the capacity of thought, right? Like reaching the edge of the ocean? Or is it more opening thought itself to its capacity to go more deeply while remaining thought? I'd say more the second, but I don't reject the first. I think those are both interesting formulations. And you could work with either one. But I think it's the idea that, you know, one of the ways to talk about this, and I've been interested, I guess, in this idea of symbols, which Rinpoche uses here. One of the ways to think about this is the things you think about are not things. You know, that is, you say, well, I wonder what an object is really like. So, and you think about that, and you say, well, what if I reach out and touch it? And then you investigate. Well, thinking things through, I think, means allowing for the possibility that the usual elements that enter into our thinking, like objects, are symbols of a higher possibility, not taking for granted what they are. So you're using thought, but you're not accepting the assumptions that thought makes. Let's go with that. I wanted to give us a couple of minutes to practice, so let me try to condense here just a bit. So it's on page 136 that Rinpoche starts talking about these three stages in appreciating time. In our reading, we only go into the second stage. We don't get to the third stage. But he starts with the idea that, you know, we have these two ways of thinking about time. One is that time is an abstract index. In other words, you know, it's 9 o'clock now, and then it's going to be 5 o'clock later, and that's time as an index. Or next year I'll do this, that kind of measuring up. Time is an abstract way of measuring things up. But it's also true that time bears down on us. You know, I have too much to do, and I'm getting old, and I'm a victim of time. I'm subject to its relentless force. I think the very fact that we have these two ways is a sign that we haven't really integrated our understanding of time, that we have, that our understanding or our relationship to time is distant or alienated. You know, we know some things about time, and they're kind of discouraging things in the sense that we can't control time, mostly that. But we don't really have an experience of time at all. So we keep trying to work with time, as the reading says on 137, lower time is a way of trying to appropriate the power of time. We try to make sense out of things. And just in the sense that, you know, it's very helpful to have a calendar, right? You say, well, I'll meet you tomorrow at 4 o'clock. And in fact, you both show up at the same time. That's good. That's nice. That's a kind of a simple example of how we appropriate the power of time, but we don't really understand time or experience time directly. And notice that the way Rinpoche says that, he doesn't say the self appropriates time, because the self doesn't have the power to appropriate time. He says lower time amounts to an attempted taming and appropriation of great time for egoistic purposes. So lower time has this sense of the self inherent in it and fundamental to it. And it's not the self that's doing that. The self is an expression of that. It's just the opposite of how we usually think, because one of the big deals about being a self is that we're the one who does things. But that's maybe a kind of a clue to how it looks different from a TSK perspective. He does say, and let's just go to this practice. There are some things I'm going to skip here, and maybe I'll get into them in the orientation. I'll go back and cover some of them. But let's go ahead and spend at least a few minutes on the practice here, because it's introduced right at this point. He says at the bottom of 137, he says, we might try to control time. That would be pretty much the self's way of thinking about it. So in other words, time is only a background phenomenon. We really don't experience it at all. I'm kind of paraphrasing what's at the bottom of 137. He says, the only way that great time and space are actually represented, that is our only contact with them, is in the fact that the objects we perceive are not totally impervious. They are not eternal isolates. In other words, objects interact with each other, and we interact with objects. And that possibility of interaction is itself at least a local representative, to use that language, of the power of time. And I thought it would be a good idea to work with that a little bit. So he says they interact with, as objects, interact with and enter into each other. Sometimes the interactions are pleasant, sometimes they're frustrating, but at least we have the fact of interaction. And when we try to control things technologically, and this is another point, but when we try to control things technologically, it's like we acknowledge the interaction, but we can't really enter into it. We can't engage it. And so we try to control things in another way. What I'm going to have us do for a couple of minutes now, and then we can comment on it a little, people may have some comments, is see if you can get into the interaction, if you can kind of experience the power of interacting with something. And I'm going to do this in an imaginative way. So just look around the room or wherever it is that you are right now. I'll assume you're mostly in rooms. Look around the room and imagine that you were out in the space of the room with all of the objects that you see in the room around you. And imagine that you're actually just interacting with them, touching them, maybe picking them up, but just a little fantasy, kind of a little imagination. But the sense here is that you are engaged with, you are involved with the objects that you encounter. And the point here, as you do that little fantasy, that little imagination, is to have a sense that as you do that, you're really, it's only possible because you're engaging the dynamic of time. You're engaging the power of time. So one way of seeing that is that it takes time to handle an object. But another way is just to say, well, how is it even possible for objects to interact with me or with each other? But right now we're going to imagine, you know, I interact with the object. How is that even possible? We take it for granted, of course. But think of it as the power of time. So let's try that for a couple of minutes. We're just following the suggestion in the text, okay? And then we'll have a little time for comment. Okay. Okay, so taking our interactions as a kind of a local representative. I find myself using that term quite a bit. It seems to be helpful. As a way of really engaging time. Because Rinpoche has said, we don't engage time. We're not in touch with it. We're cut off from it. So, what do you find? I'm going to give people a chance to comment. We'll go on for a few minutes longer, see if people have something to say. You might think of this as related to a kind of scientific understanding of what things really are. They're objects, you know, they're always in motion. A little bit like that, but only a little bit, partly for the reasons we've said, because science is just a theoretical take on all of this. So Hayward says, the position in the room defines the view, and the view defines the position. Yeah, and that in itself is a kind of interaction, isn't it? Or my position in the room. We're always interacting with our world in that sense. You know, we're being put in place. You know, we're being set up by the world that we encounter. So that's one aspect of it, absolutely. While I'm waiting for people, I'm going to make a point, which is again a kind of a language point. He's saying that the things we encounter, this is on the top of page 140, he's saying the things we encounter are not false, and they're also not totally determined by the fact that we encounter them. They are the way that time is playing. There's a couple more comments. Let me just make this point quickly. He says, this is the enthralling play of time. And that's a very carefully chosen word, I'm sure, the word enthrall, because in English, our usual sense of enthrall means it's wonderful. I'm trying to stay away from the real meaning. it's you know, what an enthralling performance. It was so moving and inspiring and so on. And we'd actually kind of like to move toward that sense. But the literal meaning of the word enthrall is to put into slavery. A thrall is a slave in Latin or something. And ordinarily we're enslaved by the relationships we have with the world. If we see them as manifestations of time, something maybe opens up, something that goes toward greater appreciation. Okay, so Caroline asks, I think in response to Hayward's question, Klaus, I see yours is up there too, but Caroline asks, how does position and view relate to time? So Hayward says, my view determines my position determines my view. And that was actually my first reaction too. It seemed like that's more of a space perception. It has more to do with the space dimension of our experience. But I, you know, when I look, and maybe you want to say something about that, Hayward, but when I looked at that, I thought, well, there's still the interaction. It's just a way of talking about the interaction. So that kind of determination of the here I am, this particular location, is still a way of interacting with time. So you can always find, if you see space, you can always find time, I suppose. Okay, Klaus said, the senses are our tools of interaction. I feel that mostly with seeing. Yeah, so how do you interact? So, one possibility that I tried in that little exercise was to imagine myself sitting down. But, of course, whether I really had the sense in my imagination of settling into the chair and, you know, I kind of can get a sense, especially now that I'm speaking of it. But no, it's not as strong as seeing. We're very visually oriented. Okay. David says, commenting on the exercise, becoming aware of the flux of the interconnectedness of all I encounter. Yeah, that's nicely put because, you know, you can talk about interconnection, you can talk about interaction, which is the word Rinpoche uses, and in doing that, you're evoking a dynamic, a movement, and the word flux points towards that. Flux is related basically to the word flow, right? So when we interact with things, we depend on a kind of a flowing, the underlying flow of experience, maybe you could put it that way. And that's, I think, where this little exercise is pointing. Michael says, encountering things feels like responding to their invitation to come into their orbit. Appreciation amounts to saying thank you for the invitation. Well, that's nicely put, and I think it goes in the direction that this exercise suggests, and I'm not going to say any more about it. And John, so we have several people here. That's great. John says, time can penetrate any space. Space has dimension because of time, and interactions are that power of exploring space that time can infinitely do. Now, so I'm going to focus on the verb in that sentence, the word explore. Because when we reach out to explore in our imagination, but this is also something you could do, of course, in any of your encounters. We're always engaging and exploring the world around us. And that's time's power that makes that possible. I think that's exactly right. And Remco says, everything I do seems to be an interaction. Yes, even imagination or doing nothing is a representation of all that's going on in and through me. Yeah, I think that that's right, that there's always interaction. And then you use these, the word imagination, and you also use the word representation. So the one I'd look at more carefully there is the word representation. I'm not quite sure how that fits. I'm not saying it doesn't, I'm just not sure how. And then Eliana says, and we'll stop here. She says, everything changes when I let the room and the objects interact with me. Things become lighter. Yeah, good. And that's a very nice suggestion, I think, that maybe a way to bring this practice to life is to let the things be what interact with you rather than you being the one that interacts with the things. So that's a suggestion, too. Now, for that you can work with during the week ahead. I'm going to give you another practice, a kind of a walk-around practice for the week. But this is a great one to look at, and it doesn't, you know, the whole idea of walk-around practices is that they don't take extra time. So anytime you feel like it, you can explore this. Okay, we'll stop there. I'm sorry I kept you a little late. And we'll move on to knowledge next week. Don't think that we're leaving time behind. We will be back. We will be back. Okay. Thank you very much, everyone.